I have to tell the people about the Patreon.
Yes, you do. Patreon.com/SMDB. SMDB, like so many damn books.
For just a dollar, you can join up and you get access to all the exclusive content that I record just for the Patreon. Also, you get to join the book club. Oh, there's so many damn books book club. It's been some of the best conversations I've had about books.
It really always sounds like a blast. I'll usually like come home and just hear like giggles coming from the library. So it's a great time. You should join.
And I would love to have more people join the fray.
You may or may not know that Christopher runs this whole show himself on the hosting side, on the technical side, everything. This is a one-man show, truly. He does it all. Support your boy, Christopher.
Even at the dollar level really helps. So join up. Patreon.com/SMDB. I'd love to have you.
Patreon.com/SMDB.
On with the show. Are you ready to go? Are you ready to talk books?
I am ready.
When are we not ready to talk books, right?
So many damn books.
Welcome to So Many Damn Books, a blessing, a curse, a podcast. My name is Christopher, and joining me in the Zoom Damn Library hyperspace is Anthony Mara. Hi, Anthony.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me on.
I'm so excited to have you here. Anthony Mara is the New York Times bestselling author of The Sorrow of Love and Techno, A Constellation of Vital Phenomena. He's the winner of the National Book Critics Circle's John Leonard Prize and the Innisfield Wolf Book Award, and longlisted for the National Book Award. He lives in Connecticut, and he is just out with his newest novel, Mercury Pictures Presents. And I loved it. I'm so excited to talk about it. I'm so excited to have you here.
Thank you so much. This is, this is a real treat. We'll have a damn good time if I say so.
I was thinking of different ways to honor a boozeless request, and there was so many interesting parts of the book. And I was actually in this really neat little Italian grocery very near my apartment that just has some Italian pastas and sauces and things, and they also have a selection of bitter Italian sodas. Mm-hmm. So I found this one called Crodino, which is sort of citrusy and very, very, very herbal and bitter on the end. It tastes so much like Campari or Aperol or something. And I thought it'd just be fun to do in honor of this book, which is so Italy meets America. I just thought Coca-Cola and Crodino. So I did it in 3-to-1 Coke, 3 parts Coke, 1 part Crodino, and it makes this lovely little aperitif cocktail sort of.
I'm gonna write down this recipe. This sounds fantastic.
I'm calling it the Italian American. And it's honestly, it's like it dials up the herbal flavors in Coke, and it also dials back the sort of bitterness at the end of the soda. So it kind of makes a really delicious, like unexpectedly good, like summertime treat cocktail.
Yeah, I've never tried that type of bitters, but there's a similar what sounds like maybe a similar brand called Sand Bitter.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Which I do have all the time. So I'll have to switch it up and try that.
They were right next to each other on the shelf. I could have chosen Sand Bitter, but I thought maybe this, because it's a little bit, Sand Bitter is very bright red, orange, red, and this is much more mellow. I thought it would look pleasing. I don't know why that was what I was choosing between.
Like how many, what's your ratio of sort of cocktails to mocktails on the show?
It comes up, I think like 1 in 5 or so.
You okay. Know?
Yeah. I like being challenged to come up with things, even if there isn't alcohol in it. And yeah, this was a fun. Are you drinking anything fun for the recording here?
You know, I am not as fun as you. I have a seltzer water, Spindrift.
Oh, Spindrift. Yeah. Spindrift,
very good.
Yeah, I've always loved them.
I've sort of become a seltzer fanatic as of late. I don't drink, and so there's always, you know, there's only so many fun things you can do when you're a toddler.
I do think that there's, you know, this is the time to be, to remain into cocktails, but not want any alcohol. I just feel like there's more and more fun, you know, non-spirited drinks that are, I mean, there's like whole shops in New York dedicated to it.
Totally. I feel like Seed Lips is everywhere. I do think that, you know, that there's a certain level of maybe health consciousness or, you know, wanting to, it's sort of like dry January stretches longer each year. But I've kind of gotten into making shrubs recently.
Oh, that's so much fun.
Yeah, I mean, just like throwing some balsamic vinegar and strawberries into some Tupperware and just sticking in the fridge for a few days, and you know, you're set. There's I feel like that's an area of, I mean, obviously you can use shrubs in regular cocktails, but with a little seltzer water, I feel like, you know, a little shrub soda is perfect in the summer.
Oh, it's so amazing. Yeah, and you can get really creative with the fruits and stuff that you're using and throw in herbs and things too. Like, it can be real, you can get really crazy with shrubs. I love them too.
Yeah.
Kiwi shrub is what I kind of, kiwi lime.
Oh, you know? Wow.
Yeah.
Do you make it yourself or, mm-hmm. or wow. So yeah. you're like, are you like a mixologist with sort of like a side hustle as a podcaster?
It's just after 8 years of doing this book podcast and hundreds of cocktails, it's just, I've, you know, you have to come up with different things. You can't just keep making, although of course there's probably 15 old fashioned variants mm-hmm. that you just end up having to make a bunch of different things.
Yeah.
So I've become more of an expert than I ever thought I would be. When I was first beginning this idea, I thought, oh, sure, I'll run through a couple ideas. And then it turns out, down the line, I'm making kiwi lime shrub and wondering, like, what is it? What book will this fit with?
Yeah. Were you making companion cocktails from the very first episode, or was it a later development?
It came along with guests. Mm. As soon as we started having guests in, I started thinking, like, I want to have another reason for them to be here, and also alcohol can help with those for us and for them, like and sometimes some of those early episodes you can really feel that we've had a few cocktails. So yeah, it was an early part of the show, and I think it's one of my favorite parts. But I'm not, why are you interviewing me? I'm supposed to be interviewing you. I'd love to know if you've got any good books recently. What did you buy? Have you bought anything? Has anything been sent your way?
Yeah, so I've purchased a number of books while I was on book tour. I sort of at every stop, I picked up one or two. So I came home with, about 40 pounds of hard covers sort of weighing me down. Let me think. So Trust by Hernan Diaz was a book that I acquired recently and absolutely loved. Just one of the smartest uses of sort of like novel of like a novel inside a novel that I've come across in a while. Just structurally really interesting. Sort of reminds me a bit of David Mitchell. When I was in Oxford, Mississippi, the bookseller at Square Books hand sold me a couple of books. One was called Underworld Jazz or Jazz in the Underworld, something like mm-hmm. that, about the history of jazz music and the mob, which I haven't started, but it sounds fascinating.
Dangerous Rhythms by TJ English.
There we go. Yes.
Nice.
Yeah. Booth by Karen Joy Fowler I acquired recently.
I got to study with her when I was in undergrad, and she was an absolutely incredible teacher. I'm very excited about that book.
I bet. Have you read it?
No, I haven't read it yet, but I've loved everything else of hers. Yeah. So
yeah, she is absolutely brilliant, I think. What else? The Candy House by Jennifer Egan, which was so good. And interesting, obviously, we'll talk about A Visit from the Goon Squad later, but so interesting to see how those two books are connected, how like the link story format sort of exists within each book individually, but also stretches in between the two novels as well.
I feel like that must have been very fun for her to, like, I wonder if she has like one of those, you know, FBI boards with like yarns.
Yeah,
between
exactly. Yeah. She's hunting a serial killer.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's interesting. I would really be curious, just because there are so many connections and little linkages in her books that you would think that she would have to have some sort of like master, blueprint in terms,
right,
just to keep everything straight. But I also think at the same time, when you're like living in a book for that long, you become so immersed in it that all of that sort of just exists inside your mind. Like I never, my walls are bare and we are in whatsoever.
Right. The Egan-verse is just within her brain. So
yeah. It's interesting. Like how, you know, I feel like for so long, like TV, particularly TV has drawn upon the conventions and traditions of the novel, that, you know, sort of starting with, I don't know, maybe The Wire or The Sopranos, the idea of having sort of these season long arcs in which every mm-hmm. episode is a chapter rather than, you know, self-contained, that after like drawing from novels for so long, now it feels like novels are drawing almost from the cinematic and television universe in terms of having these like Marvel universes of Egan or David Mitchell, this sort of like larger, sort of connective tissue between books.
Yeah, I feel like that can be really fun. It can also have the opposite version of sometimes being distracting, of like taking you out, and then you're looking and you're not thinking about the story at hand, but you're thinking of the like strings that they're you know, drawing on their FBI, on their murder boards.
Yeah.
But I do think it can be really, I mean, like even Stephen King has been doing it for so long mm-hmm. too, of doing this sort of, if you read them all, they're all actually set in the same sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely like the worst town in Maine to live. Like,
don't live in Derry. Just don't do it.
Don't do it. Yeah. Yeah.
I got a couple really exciting books. This one was sent to me. It's Bliss Montage, the Ling Ma story collection. Her novel Severance, which has nothing to do with the Apple TV show, is one of my absolute favorites of the sort of post-apocalyptic literary novels that came out. It was really, really high up there for me. And so I'm really excited to read some of her other stories where she's not in this tradition that's kind of coming out right now. And then I also got this really exciting book called Myco Kings by Leanne Howe. And it was on a list of time travel books, but it's about, I don't see on the book where the time travel comes in, because it's about a baseball team in 1907 made up of all Native American players playing against their arch rivals of another territory. And it's one game at the end of their series, and you're following all the players amidst it in Oklahoma. And I'm so excited about all of that. You know, I'm really interested in the time period. I don't really like watching baseball, but I love reading baseball novels. And one of my absolute favorite baseball novels is a time travel novel by Daryl Brock called If I Never Get Back. And so I'm really excited to read another. I don't know. It really doesn't have any time travel written on in the blurbs and stuff. So I wonder how that ended up on the list.
So were you interested in it initially because it was on this time travel list? Are you into time travel as sort of as a trope?
Absolutely. Yeah, mm-hmm. I really love time travel methods, especially when it's not necessarily a machine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really like Jack Finney's version. He wrote Invasion of the Body Snatchers, but he also wrote a duology of time travel novels where what you do is you just make sure you're in a in a building that was existing in the time that you wanted to be in, and you have to wear all the clothes of the time you want to be in and make sure your view is just of that time. And eventually, if you live that way long enough, you'll slip.
Interesting.
That's really fun. Yeah.
Did you read that book, Time Travel by James Glick, I think his name is?
The nonfiction writer?
Yeah. Yeah. He wrote a novel, or excuse me, a nonfiction account on time travel in, it seems like it would be right up your alley. It sort of begins with W.G. Wells and sort of looks at time travel across, sort of across culture in the 20th century. Really interesting, though.
See, this came out in late September 2016, and I feel like I can understand why I missed it. There was stuff going on in the news then. I feel like
bad time to publish a book, isn't it?
Right before a very, very contentious election. Never know, though. You never know if it's going to be a contentious election when you're writing your book.
Yeah.
But this is right up my alley. I'm very excited about that. Yeah. I just know his other book, The Information, where he was.
Yeah, that was great too.
Which was amazing. Yeah, and I love him on Twitter. He's actually one of the reasons to stay on Twitter. There aren't many, but James Glick's is pretty good.
I have a Twitter account, but I check in like maybe once every 2 months.
I think that's the way to do it.
Yeah.
I took it off my phone recently, and that was great for mental health.
You know what I started doing? So my publisher was encouraging me to, as Mercury Pictures Presents was, after I turned it in, was encouraging me to do something to engage with the world outside of my, my apartment. And because I am not a huge fan of social media, I started a newsletter. Like a free monthly newsletter that Random House puts out, and it's been one of the most gratifying things I've done in quite a while. I just sort of usually it's some aspect of research that I dive into, but it's just been such a great way to connect with readers, and they send me emails and I send them emails back, and
That's so fun.
Yeah, and I've picked up like a lot of great book recommendations, like there's a I solicit book recommendations, and in each month's newsletter sort of go into what everybody has sent in, and it's been a very nice way to sort of have the experience of social media without wanting to.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like my overall favorite social network. Remains LiveJournal, which was like which is dating myself, of course, because it was very, very popular when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of that, where you really were only writing for your friends, but you were writing these long missives about what you were getting into. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like that was the best form of, and now you've sort of reverse engineered it with a publicist telling you to. It's kind of great. Yeah.
Exactly.
Your novel, Mercury Pictures Presents. I'd love to for you to tell our listeners who might not know the book yet what it's about.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a novel set in Los Angeles and Italy in the 1940s. Frank Lloyd Wright once said that if you tip the world on its side, all the loose pieces will land in Los Angeles. And this was never more true than it was in the 30s and 40s, when thousands of emigres fleeing Europe landed in LA. Many of them ended up working at the margins of Hollywood, very far from the glitz and the glamour. And I was interested in exploring this fascinating community through the eyes of a character named Maria Lagana, who works as an associate producer at Mercury Pictures, which is a struggling B-movie studio that becomes a hub for European refugees during this period. Maria is this tough, ambitious, irreverent striver. I sort of pictured her as Rosalind Russell's character in His Girl Friday, only nice. A bit more salty and a lot. She grew up in Italy and fled to the U.S. with her mother after a childhood transgression led to her father's arrest. And so over the course of the book, she has sort of reinvented herself as this unflappable producer, but remains haunted by the role she played in her father's fate, until one day among the various emigres who come to find work at Mercury, she sees a man from her father's past. And with his appearance, the various fictions that she's spun to survive in exile begin to unravel. It's a sort of big transporting novel about the promise of reinvention, the ways that politics and art entwine, and how this unlikely group of emigres made a home in this very unlikely place and transformed American culture in the process.
Wow. Yeah, that is so many people, when they get asked that question, that it totally knocks them back for a second. They're like, oh, right, I have to sell my book again. But you've got it down. it's like you've been on a book tour recently or something. What's funny about this book in the body of your work is it feels like your most straightforward as an Anthony Mara novel gets. Can you talk to me about how it appeared to you? You know, usually it feels like there's pieces and you're doing these novels and stories, but this one felt much more. Yeah. What led you to the more cohesive novel structure?
Yeah, it's interesting. In the final form, it feels pretty cohesive. But for almost the entire drafting process, it was rather fragmented. I began working on this book in, I would say, around 2014. And at the time, both Consolation and Tsar took me around 2 years apiece to write. And so I figured that with a little luck, I would finish it while Obama was still in office.
Right.
Needless to say, it didn't really pan out that way. But even though Hollywood feels as existentially and geopolitically remote from, the world of Tsar or Constellation, in some ways, it's always felt to me very much of a piece with those books, particularly with Tsar. I feel like a lot of the ideas, revolving around like propaganda and censorship, and sort of the friction between the state and individual citizens that I was really interested in exploring in Tsar, sort of carried over into this project. One of the things as a writer that I think I've always been drawn to are places where kind of anything can happen. And that was, certainly the case in the Soviet Union and it's absolutely, obviously, the case in Hollywood. So I came to the project sort of through that, that the lens of those previous books. And I initially really did want to try to write something that was a bit more straightforward. I feel like with each book, you kind of want to try, something a little bit different. And so doing something that, while this obviously moves around in time and space and has, a bajillion characters running around, it does feel to me like a slightly more traditional than my first two books.
Yeah, I felt that, but I also didn't feel like I was losing the Mara-ness that I I think one of those reasons is because one thing that I love that seems like a love of yours is just artwork and its provenance, like how a painting gets moved or how just not even necessarily paintings, but drawings get lost or found. Mm-hmm. What does art unlock for you in that way?
Yeah. So my wife is an art historian. She specializes in photography. And one of the things that I've always been struck by when, we go to a museum is how if there's a particular artist whom she's, spent time working on, is is she can, you know, she'll give you the history of a particular painting or photograph. And oftentimes the backstory is much more interesting and moving than, you know, than the object itself. And I think there's something about the stories behind creative works that I just find just so absorbing and interesting. And so yeah, you're absolutely right that I feel like, you know, certainly in Czar, the entire book was sort of structured around these stories behind, you know, one particular painting and several censored photographs. In this book, it's sort of the stories behind a number of films. I also think that that there's something about the way that art allows you to access a moment in history. I think that many of my characters are sort of struggling to understand the complicated, often very absurd situations and histories that they find themselves in, and the nature of truth to them is often very slippery. And sort of the only way that many of them can even understand what is going on in their lives and in their countries is to sort of piece it together long afterwards. And often it is through a work of art is how they come to that.
I feel like this was coming to a head in the war photography, war filming, which was also, even though it was very harrowing, it somehow felt like some of the funniest stuff of them like filming truly horrific stuff and being like, okay, this isn't going to look very good, good on camera. Like, we're going to have to refilm some of this or restage it. I was totally fascinated by that. Was that based off of it? Was that something you found in your research?
Yeah. So one of the things that was really strange in writing this book is when I began, as I said, it was in 2014. And so, you know, democracy seemed secure, like the world of this book felt very much like something locked in the past. You know, right.
There aren't any fascists anymore, probably.
Exactly. You know, it's never a good sign when a novel set in the 40s seems topical again, is it? It's,
yeah.
So sort of as I, over the course of, you know, the, whatever it was, 6 or 7 years that I was writing this book, a lot of the sort of the ways in which, you know, our own country, you know, in the late teens, with Trump's presidency, the sort of echoes and ramifications between this period in the 40s and today really, you know, felt rather resonant, shall we say. And in thinking of sort of like the idea of misinformation and the production of, you know, fake news, quote unquote, was something that really began to stick out to me. And so in terms of how this was used in the 40s in propaganda movies, there was this real need particularly in 1943 and 44, at that point, sort of the American home front had, you know, become rather dispirited by the slow progress of the war. And Roosevelt really felt that in order to mobilize public support for, you know, America's involvement in the war, that the public needed to see what soldiers on the front line were experiencing. Mm-hmm. And so there became this like this real campaign to photograph and to film, you know, frontline sort of skirmishes. The problem, of course, is that camera technology at the time didn't allow you to do that. Even the most in the most controlled environment on a Hollywood soundstage, where you could, you know, everything was under the director's control. You still need to do several takes in order to get, you know, the right the right shot. And so this became very complicated in the battlefield. Like, how would you go about filming, a frontline conflict? It was the cameras at the time could only film about 30 seconds of footage before they had to be, the film had to be reloaded. The cameras themselves were, had all of these chrome parts, so they would just dazzle in the sun. So they were frequent targets. Cameramen were frequent targets for snipers. Which means that all of the soldiers themselves, wanted to steer clear of them. Right. So,
well, that's not good for footage. Come on, you guys.
It's not good for footage at all. And so, the question that a lot of these directors and cameramen who were sent out into the field of battle was how do you capture something that you can't capture given the technological limitations of the time? And the answer in some cases became you simply film reenactments. And this was most famous in a movie called San Pietro by none other than John Huston. Mm. John Huston went to this small village in southern Italy, and he arrived on sort of like the last day of its liberation. And he spent the next several months basically restaging this battle.
Wow.
And he ended up, going to great lengths in terms of, interviewing all the soldiers who were involved and, trying to create an accurate reproduction of this battle. But of course, he was filming something as, a documentary that was entirely dramatized. Wow. And, the poor Italian villagers, were watching their village get bombed a second time in order for it to be caught on camera.
Was this an area of cinema that you already had an interest in before 2014? Were you already interested in the films of the 40s and the time period, or was it something you found in research?
It was mostly through research. I've been interested in sort of film propaganda sort of emerging out of the Soviet Union. More people died in the in Eisenstein's reenactment of the October Revolution and the storming of the Winter Palace than died in the actual event itself. So aspects of sort of my sojourn through Soviet history, I think sort of in this strange way led me to Hollywood and some of the films of this period as well.
Do you have any favorites that you didn't get to get into in the book?
These aren't propaganda movies, but a couple of my favorite movies of that period are by a director named Ernst Lubitsch. He is sadly, he's today probably best known for being Billy Wilder's mentor. Billy mm-hmm. Wilder had a plaque over his desk for his entire career that said, "What would Lubitsch do?" And Lubitsch was a German Jewish emigre to the U.S. and he was known for what were at the time called champagne comedies, and they were sort of these very sophisticated movies set in sort of like an alternate Europe where everybody is beautiful and depicted in the perfect lighting with the best one-liners imaginable. But he made these two movies in the late, one I believe was in 39 and the other was in 42. They were called Ninotchka and To Be or Not To Be. And Ninotchka is this very, very silly but wonderful movie about Greta Garbo. She plays this Soviet commissar who moves to Paris and, of course, falls in love and realizes, all the virtues of capitalism. But it's also like he uses humor to expose many of the, you know, grotesque and awful experiences that ordinary citizens in the Soviet Union endured at the time. Similarly, in To Be or Not to Be, which stars Jack Benny, it's this sort of screwball comedy that's set in Poland in the early 40s, and it seems like this movie that shouldn't work at all. And it's about this sort of theater troupe that uses its capacity to deceive in order to escape Poland. And again, he just uses satire like a scalpel to completely show how vacuous and empty the culture and morals of the Nazi occupiers are. It's a really stunningly good movie, so I would highly recommend that.
In the back of your novel is an incredible reading list, like so many awesome books, and it just seems like a testament to your own thoroughness as a researcher. Does the research come first for you, or the story? When do those things come together? And I guess, you know, do all of your passions end up on your pages?
Yeah, it's interesting. I kind of feel like one of the you know, real pleasures of being a writer is that it gives you the excuse to sort of become an amateur expert in a particular subject you're interested in for a few years, and the book a book almost becomes the vessel in which you're trying to pour your enthusiasms, and that was certainly the case with this. You know, research is, for me, it's the first thing. It precedes the writing and it outlives it. It's what I begin long before I, you know, put the pen to the page, and I continue it, you know, after I've turned in, the last round of copy edits. And writers, I think, often discuss research in terms of archaeology, that it's this process of unearthing or excavating. But for me, it's always seemed more like map making. That research is sort of how you are figuring out what the borders of, you know, this fictional world is, and sort of each little interesting nugget or anecdote that you come upon in research, in your research, sort of becomes a little pin on your map, and it ends up sort of giving the shape and structure to the novel itself, where you're sort of figuring out how can I move from this point to that point in the most logical and expeditious path as possible. It's sort of like you need to, so for instance, you know, some of the book is set in Italy in the 1930s, some is set in Los Angeles. Some is set in the Utah desert, where a sort of life-size replica of a Berlin neighborhood is built. So you have like these various scenes and various settings, and you're trying to figure out how can I plausibly create a narrative structure that will be able to contain them all. And so research for me is absolutely about that sense of trying to not only like give, you know, interesting sort of color to a piece and, you know, a vague sense of historical accuracy, but it's also really about trying to figure out the narrative shape itself.
That's so exciting, and that feels so true, that it's just like I'm gonna pick all of these things that jumped out to me, and then I'm gonna find a way to connect them all. But at the same time, it doesn't feel like that's what you were doing. Like I, as it can sometimes in historical fiction, I feel like sometimes, especially when you're dealing with Hollywood, I think of it with E.L. Doctorow sometimes, that you're just waiting for the next name to peer up on the page, that you're like, it's that person I know, and this writer is gonna give their absolute best impression as much as they can on the page of this person. But your work didn't deal with that. It sort of elided that. And I wondered if that was a conscious choice, or it's just that helped that your story was about a a B movie studio that wasn't going to come into contact with those people anyway.
I absolutely think that's such a good point, and something that I did actively try to avoid. There's Edward St. Aubyn, in his Patrick Melrose novels, at one point he has this line where a character is talking about historical fiction and how she loves it because sort of characters, all these famous people seem to be, you know, bumping into each other, you know, all the time, like some party that, you know, is appears in the pages of a tabloid. And, mm-hmm. You know, that's not what necessarily you wanted, you know, what you want to do. So with this book, I allowed myself one celebrity.
Okay.
That was it, and it was Bela Lugosi, and after Bela Lugosi, I said, okay, like that's it. We're sticking to the, you know, to fictional creations. I think that there is, as you know, as you pointed out, there is a interest in or a natural impulse to avail yourself of all the, you know, wondrous personalities that the period allows, but you don't want it to seem like, you know, an episode of E! True Hollywood Story or something.
Right. So Maria works for Artie Feldman, he sort of has what I was thinking about this when you brought when you said you wanted to read Jennifer Egan's A Visit from the Goon Squad with me, which I read when it came out, and I was very excited to return to it. But sort of Artie Feldman and Maria sort of have a spiritual predecessor in some ways with Sasha and Benny Salazar. Mm-hmm. And I was curious, what made you were you thinking about that when you were deciding to recommend that book to me, or what brought A Visit from the Goon Squad across your desk again?
So actually, A Visit. I'm out here in Iowa City. I'm teaching at the Iowa Writers Workshop this fall, and I am doing a class on linked story collections, or novels and stories, sort of however you wanna. There's really no good term for that, is there? I feel like linked story seems like a dating app, and novels is just very, very cumbersome, but the first one that we're going to read is going to be A Visit from the Goon Squad. I think that that Goon Squad and Olive Kittredge, both those two books, I think they came out within a year or two of each other. You know, they both won Pulitzer Prizes and were very you know, highly regarded. I feel like those two books did so much for the linked story collection in terms of creating a readership for it. It sort of, you know, obviously it's been a form that's been around for you know, at least 100 years, and it's, you know, it's sort of roots stretch back much longer, but I think it was like 2007, 2008 with Goon Squad and Olive Kittredge that it really sort of became a form that came into public prominence. In terms of Sasha and Benny, yeah, I mean, I think that sort of the there's something very classic in sort of the setup of a boss who's maybe past his prime and a bit over his skis in many regards, and sort of an assistant who is kind of really shouldering the burden of right. The enterprise.
Right, it's a grand tradition.
Exactly. Yeah, like it's interesting. I hadn't actually thought of Sasha and Benny until I was, you know, going back through it this past week. The sort of the model that I was thinking of a lot was His Girl Friday, mm-hmm. Rosalind Russell and Cary Grant, and sort of there. But that is a very similar relationship to Sasha and Benny, you know, except obviously without the romance.
Right. Well, I think it's also connected to your work in another way too, where Egan followed up Visit from the Goon Squad with her own sort of historical novel, like going back and going into a World War II book. Mm-hmm. And you know, Mercury Pictures Presents comes after you've done a linked short story collection that, I don't know, I could see, do you think that there's something to that about wanting to go into like a, after being all through history, it was like, no, I want to go to one spot.
Yeah. I absolutely think there's something about wanting to, like, each book, you almost want to do the opposite of what you did the last time in some ways. So with After Constellation, which was told in this sort of grand sweeping omniscience, with Czar, I wanted to do something where I was almost exclusively doing first person narrators. And, you know, after something like Czar, where it moves through about 100 years of Soviet history, of Soviet and Russian history, with this book, I was very, very interested in just like let's just look at this more, you know, much more narrow, constrained band of time. It's kind of interesting, like when thinking about, you know, I still have no idea what I'm gonna write next, but the impulse to sort of go in the opposite direction of what you last did, I feel like it keeps you, it just maybe keeps you, your mind a bit more agile.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, there, one of the things that I love in all Link's short story collections, but I think particularly in Goon Squad, is that joy of filling in the gaps yourself between the stories. Like you're going to get two stories, they're fully apart in time, but you can sort of be like, oh, okay, they got divorced, they got married, that person had a kid, and now we're here. Mm-hmm. I'm how do those things strike you when you're thinking, do you know, are you coming at these things from a craft perspective all the time?
Yeah, so one of the things that I love about the Link story form is that it takes so much of what people claim to dislike about short story collections and leverages it to its advantage. So one of the reasons that I think a lot of readers are maybe a bit cold on short story collections is the fragmentation. Mm-hmm. That you know, you're sort of, every new story you're introduced to a new set of characters that you don't have the sort of long narrative arc that a novel provides. And I think that the effect of that is that people, you know, often sort of see short story collections as being minor works, sort of, you know, what a novelist does when they're feeling a bit lazy. What I think is so lovely about a linked short story collection is that it uses that very fragmentation to tell a narrative that is often much larger and more capacious than anything you could fit in a traditional novel. I mean, Goon Squad is probably half as long as Manhattan Beach, but it feels like it has, you know, eight times as much story and so much more kind of spread in terms of its reach. And I feel like it that capacity for a linked story collection to really leverage the fragmented nature of the short story form is one of its great strengths.
Yeah, I mean, very few books could have like A Lion, Safari, Kleptomania, and like Bands for Babies, like all in the same grouping of stories.
So here's a question for you.
Okay.
Do you consider this a novel or like a collection of linked stories or a short story collection?
This time through, I found it to be far more of a short story collection than I remembered it, because there was just full stories that I completely forgot about, or they didn't hit me like they did. Mm-hmm. And I walked away from it so impressed by the PowerPoint chapter and really like carried that around with me that like other stuff really faded. Mm-hmm. But I think that because that PowerPoint chapter is so powerful and comes where it does, it sort of really takes it into the short story area for me, even though that you're going to see some of those characters again. So many of the stories are quite different from each other too, they feel different, and so yeah, but I don't think that means I also don't have any problem with that. I don't have that same like problem with short story collections, because I know that even when they're not linked, it's still so meticulously planned for mood. Like you're still thinking about like, what if someone read all my stories all at once, like in one sitting, like what would that be like? Even for people that aren't writing a linked collection. So I know that the order matters no matter what.
Yeah. I think that I should say that was my assessment of the, the reading public at large and their view of short story collections, certainly not my own, but that the order and the structure of even a short story collection in which there is no linkage at all, I think you're absolutely right. It's so important and something that I feel like often gets taken for granted, that that there's this sense that, you know, the writer just sort of, you know, put these all in sort of any, you know, random sequence and no appreciation for how, you know, important the mood and the emotional sort of arc of a collection is, even when there's no connective tissue between the stories.
Totally. And I think that in rereading it, because I often don't reread, I do skip over short story collections when I'm rereading people's work sometimes. And rereading this,
disc.
I know. In rereading this, it made me think about how it kind of like an album that you're listening to, like one song that you didn't care about your first 10 times you listened. Like the 11th time, it's like, whoa, that song had something that I didn't realize. You know, that's the Scotty Benny chapter in this this read through, where they're sort of talking about regret, and it's really in between the lines of what sort of things you could regret, and how their regrets are completely different from each other, even though they're both feeling it. That hit me in a completely different way, and I would say that was the most powerful story in the book this time, even though like I didn't even quite remember it when I was going back to it.
Yeah, I didn't remember it either, and I think it also is maybe an indication just of how you change as a reader, that the book might be the same, but the experience is different just because your own, you know, circumstances have changed so much. Of, you know, I think I read this for the first time when I was probably when I was in graduate school, and you know, obviously, you know, I was a young pup then. My hair was probably the color of yours, without you know, the sort of old man winter gray that has crept in. But I was so moved by it this time. In terms of just how it deals with time and, you know, as like you just said, with the various ways that we regret and that's in a way, you know, obviously like the epigram comes from In Search of Lost Time, and so much of the book does just feel like it dwells in just all the ways that we are sort of diminished by the passage of time. It hit me in a way that I think, you know, maybe when you're in your mid-20s, you know, the passage of time seems pretty great rather than
a terrifying stealing by a mobster squad. There's a quote from her that I came across, that first of all, she was inspired by The Sopranos and
really
Lost Time. Like those were the two things together that she was like most inspired by, and also that she was saying that there's no way to avoid becoming part of the past. And she was referencing that, you know, that her daughter considers like Madonna old school. And she's listening to Lady Gaga at the time. I imagine that's all changed now. But yeah, I think that is an interesting thing to be like, you know, to be singularly obsessed over. Is like, can I stay present forever? Is just like, is that something you even want? You
know? Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I mean, in a way, it seems like that would be the worst
Yeah,
worst thing of all.
exactly. I also was thinking this time through that the near future, writing the near future is dangerous because here we
Yeah.
are, like getting very close to 2025, and I don't see anybody stopping getting tattoos or anything like
Yeah.
that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm sure that there is some some wonderful nonfiction book that goes through the various novelistic depictions of the future that are maybe not that haven't really panned out. I think that maybe we tend to think though that the future will look much different than sort of dramatically, seismically different from the present when maybe it for better or worse, rarely does.
Yeah. We just are not going to get flying cars. That doesn't make any sense. You know, I love that there was a blog, I think it still exists, but it was wonderful, called, I think it was called something like Paleo Future. And it was all just like the 1800s looking into the future. Like what would the year 2000 be like? The 1900s, you know,
Wow.
what will we do, be living like 100 years from now? And it's all push button kitchens.
Well, but I guess in God, what was it? Was it in maybe was in The Time Traveler, or The Time Machine, by H.G. Wells. Isn't there something that like vaguely resembles computers or iPads?
I think so. Yeah, there's always, I mean, even I remember when iPads were announced, and Star Trek had like exactly those. Like they were like, oh, we're moving closer to Star Trek. Yeah, I do love when they do get it right. You know, I think of Infinite Jest, where he really got Netflix. Like that was coming down the pike, that we were really gonna have like these infinite personal internet devices. Yeah.
There's this great book called The Physics of the Future by the author's last name is Kaku. His first name starts with an M. I'm blanking on it. But it's he looks he's a physicist, sort of in a popular hist popular science writer, but he looks at sort of the physics of what is possible in terms of future technological development, and sort of gives his best guess at based on where technologies are. He wrote this a couple of years ago, where technologies are in the present, what things could conceivably look like in the future. And he actually uses I think he uses Star Trek as sort of like his one of his basis points in terms of how, as you said, that in many ways it was predictive of what was coming, decades down the line.
Yeah, I also feel like the movie Minority Report, so many people are like, oh, we want to do that, you know, like in Minority Report. And it's just like, did we all watch that movie and come out of it like, I want the world to be just like that? Because I
It's
didn't
not
have
really
that.
I feel like it's more of a cautionary tale
It's
than
just
a
like, yeah.
yeah.
Although it does seem like their highways seem like they're working a lot better than they do
I mean,
now.
they had flying cars.
We should move actually into the recommendation portion of the show. Do you have anything else you'd like? You've been throwing them out all over the place, but now we're in the official time. Like, is there anything you want to recommend?
The official recommendation time. I feel like there are so many things to recommend. So I'm going to recommend something that an artsy fartsy novelist such as myself would seem like an unlikely champion for, and
Okay.
is the Lee Child Jack Reacher novels,
Oh.
which I got into maybe 2 years ago, and I've just been really loving them. That it's like the perfect, I feel like kind of like the perfect beach read. Someone once called them Harlequin for dudes, and I feel like that's exactly what it is. And, you know, as summer's winding down, if you need, you know, you need that sort of like weird sort of fantasy world where, you know, where a strapping, competent, you know, Jack Reacher saves the day, I would heartily recommend it. So a number of friends have begun reading Jack Reacher due to my pestering.
And that's
I feel like it's usually this anecdote. So this is this is from, I think, like the third book. Jack Reacher is shot, and his pectoral muscle is so thick that the bullet can't reach his heart. So like that's the level of like realism and you know intellectual depth that you're getting from
Holy child, that's amazing.
But I will also recommend, on sort of the other spectrum, I will recommend the Criterion Channel, which is like it's sort of like you know, like Netflix or something like that, but it's wonderful. They just have, you know, old movies, new movies, movies from across the globe. I feel like it's kind of, it's almost like a Netflix without like all of the stupid shit sort of mixed in. I signed up for that maybe a year ago and have really been enjoying that.
I love the making of stuff. They've got a lot of great, like, one thing that I feel like all of the streamers have forgotten is that, like, we used to really love special features on DVDs and would like specifically go get a DVD because it had cool special features. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the Criterion Channel gets like that we miss those.
Yeah. Yeah. And the you know, the documentaries that accompany a lot of those movies really are terrific. I mean, really in depth. I also love the like adventures in movie going segments where they just sort of chat with you know, a well-known writer or actor or what have you, and sort of get their you know, their favorite movies on the surface.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that.
What do you recommend?
I am going to recommend, I'm joining the chorus, I feel like, at this point. This book just came out, but Gabriel Zevin's new novel, Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, is really excellent. It follows the artistic partnership between two video game designers. And it starts with them making games that are sort of in the 90s, and it follows them making games all the way up to now. And if you, I love these types of books. I remember The Animators by Kayla Ray Whitaker, I think. Really lovely book about the creative partnership of comic book artists. And of course, you know, Cavalier and Clay. Like, I just feel like those books can be really, really satisfying in a way. Yeah. And this one is no exception. It's really, really fun, powerful, exciting type of, I did not want to stop reading it, which is also really, really lovely.
Did you ever read Wild Minds?
Oh no, I've never heard of it.
That's another one I'll recommend for my recommendation. It's a history of US animation. It's really well done.
Oh yeah, this looks really great.
Yeah, it sort of goes through sort of like the golden era of animation from the, you know, the 20s up through, I think it sort of peters out maybe in the 60s with like the Jetsons and that sort of stuff, but really just opened my own, you know, my own sense of the history of it. You know, when I think of that era, I mostly just think of like, you know, classic Disney movies, and of course there's, you know, so much more going on, and it's just like a really lively account of the period and the various artists behind some of these classic figures.
I definitely have to get this book. This is definitely up my alley. I just rewatched 101 Dalmatians, the original animated movie, for the first time in a long time. It's just absolutely gorgeous. And it's making me like going back into my animation interests. So this is right up my alley.
What do you think of like Disney's current sort of program of doing live action versions of those classic animated movies?
I thought I keep getting surprised that I like it. I haven't liked all of them, but I thought Cinderella was really magical, and I think that they can be really great. But just like anything, you know, it just comes down to vision, and sometimes I wonder, like, am I watching one that was made for money or was made because like someone actually had a real artistic idea that they were wanting to see through? But mm-hmm. just getting to see that the live action version of that dress, Cinderella's dress, was mm-hmm. like they really did something there. It felt very magical to me. Mm-hmm. What about you?
I don't know. Like on the one hand, I think it's really interesting how, as you said, the ways that technology now allows you to bring to life what could only have been represented in animated form a couple decades ago. And I think that is really cool to see. Part of me is maybe less thrilled about the fact that I feel like so much of, you know, culture in general, but particularly Disney properties revolve around basically just doing endless reboots mm-hmm. of classic material. And it seems like that just sort of seems like somewhat of a creative dead end if kind of, you know, every big blockbuster is a new version of, you know, something that came out a couple years earlier. Which for better or worse, I feel like is one of the effects of Marvel movies.
Totally. And I think sometimes they have the unintended effect of just showing how powerful and amazing animation itself can be. Like if you comparing like the live action Be Our Guest versus the animated Be Our Guest from Beauty and the Beast, that alone, I just felt like there's magic and amazing things happening in the animated version that they just couldn't do in live action for whatever reason. So I don't know. I do feel like sometimes they can really do something special, but I feel like, I don't know, groupthink maybe is taking away from some of the more special things they could possibly do.
Yeah, and it also, it seems like, I mean, I'm not sure if this is the cause or effect, but you know, it seems like the idea of a new animated, you know, big movie coming from something like Disney is completely a thing of the past. That I guess the closest is like Pixar, but you know, that's all you know, sort of computer animated.
Right. I've joined the throng calling like another 2D in it.
Yeah.
Come on. Do another one. We all like them. Come on.
Yeah.
I mean, this leads to the question that do you want to see your work adapted? Other than of course the payday, but is there something that you are there any of your stories that you would really like to see on screen?
It's interesting. I think that one of the pleasures of any adaptation is that it's almost like hearing you know, hearing a cover version of a song, that it allows another artist to take a riff on something you're familiar with, and whether they're good or bad, you know, that's something I often just enjoy, you know, with adapted novels. I think of the three books, maybe this one, Mercury, is the one that I'd most be interested in seeing adapted, just because I feel like there could be so many interesting and kind of fun ways of sort of how Hollywood portrays itself that could be interesting on screen.
Yeah, I feel like also Hollywood loves to play itself. There's like, you know, like if they can find another reason to make a movie about how great it is to make movies, they're gonna do it. So
yeah.
I feel like you're providing them an excellent excuse.
Yeah, well, let's hope there are a couple of producers tuning in today.
Oh yeah, I think that's I think last survey I did, all film producers listen.
All film producers.
It's only film. This is the book podcast for film producers only.
There we go.
Anthony, this has been so much fun. I'm so glad that you were able to come on the show. You know, my last and final recommendation is to go read Mercury Pictures Presents. It was another book where I started reading it, really didn't want to put it down. You also did some Jack Reacher short chapters things that I thought like really keep those pages moving along. So, you know, there's inspiration everywhere.
It is true. There is inspiration everywhere, even between the pages of a Lee Child novel.
For the folks who are listening to this at home, of course, I always love when you give a nice review on iTunes and support the show on patreon.com/smdb and go and buy Anthony Mara's books. If you haven't read a single one, you go read them all. But this is an excellent entry in the Mara canon. Anthony, thank you again.
Thank you so much. This was an absolute blast. I so appreciate you having me on.